Something that touched my heart, and it began this way. And just like the river, I've been running ever since. He said it's been a long time coming, but I know my change is gonna come.
That's Aretha Louise Franklin, born in Memphis, Tennessee, but raised in Detroit, with A Change Is Gonna Come. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, October the 30th. The 31st. No, it's Thursday the 31st. Oh my gosh. All right. I'm awake. It's Thursday the 31st, and we pick up from where we left off yesterday with our focus on one of the biggest stories in America, though you couldn't tell, and that is the implosion of the city of Detroit, on the brink, as it is, of being the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. A fierce battle is being waged over whether the city will be allowed by a federal bankruptcy judge to declare bankruptcy so as to keep creditors at bay while restructuring $18 billion in past due debt plus an ongoing $1 million a day deficit just to keep operating at a bare bones level. If the court rules that the city can file for bankruptcy, it will be not only the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history, but probably the first of a number of other major U.S. cities to fall. Today we look at the devastating impact Detroit's fiscal crisis has had and continues to have on city workers. And we'll continue yesterday's discussion on what is seen as a hidden agenda behind the bankruptcy, an extreme form of urban warfare, a systematic, forcible emptying of the city in order to reinvent it to suit a confluence of social, political, and economic interests that envision a different America. Detroit being a test case, in other words, for other similarly cities like Oakland, Chicago, and maybe even Washington, D.C. Herb Saunders, the managing partner of the Saunders Law Firm in Detroit, is the in-house attorney for Council 25 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, one of the unions opposing bankruptcy. Other partners, parties, include the United Automobile Workers, the UAW, Detroit's pension funds, and Detroit retirees. Thank you, Herb Saunders, for joining us today.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to join with you.
Thank you so much. We could start by asking, why is AFSCME opposing bankruptcy?
Well, first of all, I think it should be known that the unions in general are not opposed to the restructuring of debt. That is what Chapter 9 is supposed to be about. We are opposing this bankruptcy, however, because the effort goes beyond the simple restructuring of debt. The effort seeks to, number one, include pensions in the equation for the bankruptcy. It's our position that, one, our public employee pensions are protected by our state constitution, which indicates they should not be dissolved in bankruptcy. Number two, we maintain that the pensions are deferred income for our public employees. That is, that our public employees gave away through negotiation certain benefits in order to earn pensions at a later date. They worked for that money. They are now entitled to be compensated for that money. We also have a problem with the manner in which this bankruptcy is proceeding. That is, for example, as a result of the filing of the bankruptcy, all litigation concerning the city of Detroit has been stayed. That means not only have court cases been stayed, but union grievances in an effort to pursue arbitrations have been stayed. Unfair labor practice charges, which unions may bring, have been stayed. And as a result of the staying of litigation, arbitrations, and unfair labor practice charges, the city has been able to, without challenge, outsource and seek the outsourcing of practically every major department within the city of Detroit. So what we have here is under the skies of bankruptcy, the city is, in essence, through the emergency manager, contracting out all of the hardworking union jobs with pension benefits, with health care, and they are not following the outsourcing ordinance. They are not following the collective bargaining agreements in doing this. And as a result, the unions have no authority in which to challenge these efforts.
I thank you for that beginning here, because I want to follow up on many of the points that you've raised. And the first of which is the constitutionality of the bankruptcy proceeding itself. The governor, who I think it was a history-breaking moment to have the governor being subpoenaed to testify in person in such a trial, when he testified on Monday, it seemed as if he was suggesting that even he didn't know whether, in fact, this was an ironclad decision, that the authority of the state, in other words, to first determine bankruptcy. It seemed to me that that's a huge question. Is the state, does the state constitution differ from constitutions in any other state, that the governor first is the first stop in determining whether a city is to be able to be to declare bankruptcy? It seems unusual to me.
Well, Chapter 9 bankruptcy number one must be voluntarily, and pursuant to the precedent, generally speaking, a municipality would request that its state government allow it to enter into bankruptcy. I think it's very disingenuous for the governor or Kevin Orr to argue that this bankruptcy filing is voluntarily occurring on behalf of the city. Kevin Orr is appointed pursuant to PA 436 by the governor, and he reports to the governor. He's not a City of Detroit official. So there's been no request by the City of Detroit to enter into the bankruptcy. Moreover, if you look at the testimony that has occurred throughout the trial, to date there has only been one city official to testify as it relates to the bankruptcy. That was the chief of police, who was hired and appointed by the emergency manager. There's been no testimony by the mayor, by any of the city council persons, by the director of the finance or the accounting department, no testimony by anyone who preceded the emergency manager to validate the city's position or the emergency manager's position that the city is insolvent, or to suggest that this is a voluntary process that the city has entered into. So I think that is indeed one of the constitutional challenges that Kevin Orr and the state has as to whether or not this process has been voluntary. Number two, there's also the constitutionality of including the pensions. Number three, there's the constitutional issue as to whether or not the governing statute, PA 436, that Kevin Orr is acting under is indeed constitutional. There are several lawsuits challenging the constitutionality of PA 436. However, as a result of the bankruptcy, those legal challenges have been stayed. And in my opinion, the court has put the cart before the horse by holding a proceeding to determine the validity of the filing of the bankruptcy without first determining whether or not the statute under which it was filed, PA 436, is indeed constitutional.
That is exactly my question. It seemed very odd that we would have a bankruptcy proceeding without first determining certain constitutional questions and get those resolved. But in any event, would such would bankruptcy court be the correct venue for such a question?
Well, that is a fundamental question that hopefully will ultimately have to be addressed. Those individuals who have filed the challenges to PA 436 are of the belief that those constitutional questions should be addressed by an Article III court, the United States District Court. And as a result, we have sought to lift the stay that has been put on the litigation by the bankruptcy court. However, to date, the court has not made a ruling on those, on the request to lift the stay, which were filed several weeks ago.
This is a huge issue, and I'm wondering why there hasn't been an emergency response, for lack of a better term, on the part of the Obama administration, that considering Detroit is a major city, it is suffering a major crisis, and therefore a major response is in order, considering that, you know, this has been ongoing. It is happening now at the greatest magnitude, but it has been an ongoing issue. What so far has been the response of the Obama administration?
Well, unfortunately, the Obama administration has chosen not to become involved to date. Probably 4 or 5 months ago, I, along with representatives of the Rainbow Push Coalition and National Action Network, met with the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. We discussed what we believe to be the constitutional violations as a result of the implementation of PA 436, the fact that as a result, over 700,000 African Americans in Michigan have lost their voting rights on their local level, though they can vote for their mayor, city council, or school board members. Their vote means nothing because they have emergency managers in their city who can trump whatever their vote is. We had that conversation with the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She appeared to be genuinely concerned. She asked that I put my concerns in writing, which we did, pursuant to a 12-page letter that was sent to her. She subsequently indicated that she was sending our concerns and my letter to Washington. Thereafter, I received a letter from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington indicating that they recognize that we have pending litigation concerning the issues raised, and they were declining to become involved at this time. So I think it's very unfortunate that we are in a circumstance in which the Voting Rights Act is being violated, equal protection is being violated, due process is being violated, the First Amendment rights of elected officials in districts where there are emergency managers, as well as their constituents' First Amendment rights are being violated, and the U.S. attorney to date has taken a back seat and decided not to become involved.
This, I got to tell you, this is astonishing, given the magnitude of what, you know, what is going on here. This is huge. This is a huge issue. Let me ask, where AFSCME is concerned and its the clients it's representing, what could you give us an idea of the kind of money that is, on the table here?
Sure. There's a great misconception that the financial woes of Detroit and other cities around Michigan are as a result of public employees eating off of the public trough and having large incomes and large pensions. The average AFSCME employee earns around $28,000 per year. As of 2011, the poverty level for a family of four in the United States was $27,000 per year. The average AFSCME employee pension is around $19,000 per year. We had a city hall meeting a couple of years ago, sponsored by Council Member Joanne Watson, during a time in which we were negotiating a collective bargaining agreement with the city. And the city was asking for more concessions as it relates to health care contributions, cut in wages, et cetera. And we had testimony from many of our members, one in which testified that he had lost his home as a result of the last contract cuts that he took, and that he had been living in a homeless shelter for over 2 years, working full-time for the city of Detroit, and that if he were to take another cut, he doesn't know what circumstance that would leave him in. We had another lady testify that as a result of the last round of collective bargaining cuts, she had to make some decisions in her life as to what she could afford to keep and what she had to lose. And she decided that she could no longer afford to have electricity within her home.
Oh,
so for over a year, her and her family had been living without electricity, boiling their water in order to bathe and carrying lanterns around their home. So this is the type of circumstance that many of the AFSCME and city workers find themselves in. Now we find for the first time beginning the beginning of this year, pensions for pension individuals receiving pensions are being taxed. Prior to legislation that was introduced by the conservative Michigan legislature last year, pensions for public employees or employees in Michigan have not been taxed. So we have individuals who are on a fixed income in which their pensions are being taxed. They are being told that they could lose their health care in totality. Individuals less than 65 years old who are retired city employees are being told that they are going to lose their health care and be given a $125 per month voucher in which they should get their own health care. And these retired individuals stand to lose either all or at least a large portion of their pensions. So what we are doing is pretty much putting the elderly on the streets with no safety net. It is a circumstance that is remarkable It's unbelievable. The nation needs to know what's going on in Detroit and what's going on in Michigan, because this is the blueprint for the rest of the United States. Mm. If they can get away with it in Detroit and in Michigan, we will see it in Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana, and Pennsylvania. And I hope the message is carried to the people across the country sooner than later so that they can hopefully get involved and begin to join us in our efforts to fight this takeover so that it doesn't come to their state and their city.
Well, I just want to get one more piece of this. Should, God forbid, should the bankruptcy be approved, quote-unquote, be approved, what is the likely impact? What kind of a consequence is facing your clients?
I'm sorry about that. If the bankruptcy was approved, I believe you asked what type of consequence do we foresee?
Yes. To your clients, well, AFSCME.
Well, what I anticipate is that it will be devastating, number one, to our retirees to the extent that pensions are included within the bankruptcy. Number two, depending upon what happens in terms of current employees being compensated in accordance with their collective bargaining agreements, we could inevitably have individuals who qualify for public assistance, thousands of individuals who qualify for public assistance working for the city of Detroit on a full-time basis, and them and their dependents, in essence, needing and qualifying for public assistance. So it is my opinion that bankruptcy is not the answer to the financial woes that Detroit and other cities in Michigan face. Rather, the answer is to address those things that have led to the financial woes. For example, we have lost, as a result of legislation passed by the conservative state legislature, we have lost revenue sharing with the state. For years and years and years, cities across Michigan shared the state's revenue. As a result of losing that revenue, it has significantly impacted cities' ability to meet their obligations. In addition to that, the city of Detroit lost a significant portion of its tax base when the conservative legislature eliminated the residency requirement for City of Detroit employees. So individuals can work in the city now and work for the city, but they're not required to live in the city. We saw a significant exodus of city employees as a result of that legislation, significantly reducing our tax base and also leading to the housing crisis that we see Detroit in. Moreover, we've given billions and billions of dollars in tax abatements to corporations that can afford to pay the taxes or at least pay a portion of the tax. We need to revisit our tax abatement policy within the city of Detroit because there are significant dollars that we could be getting from corporations that we are not getting because of unprecedented abatements that we have given. There's over $800 million in taxes that are owed to the city, many of those dollars owed by large corporations that are collectible, and we have not made the effort to collect that money. The state has been in charge of the city since the consent decree in April 2012. Yet through the evidence presented in court, the state has not demonstrated or suggested that it's made any effort to collect the over $800 million that's owed to Detroit most of which owed by major corporations. So these are many of the things that we can and should be doing to address our financial woes as opposed to the process of bankruptcy.
In the situation now as it is, if you had to go on a kind of triage system or priority list, what would you say is the appropriate, what are the appropriate steps that should be taken now to resolve the situation?
Well, I think number one, we have to hopefully get a legal ruling that the pensions should not be a part of the bankruptcy equation, first and foremost. Secondly, it would be my hope that we address some of those issues I just delineated as opposed to entering into bankruptcy. To the extent we are unable to do that, to the extent the court does rule that the bankruptcy was filed in good faith, which I don't believe it was, and that the city is insolvent, which I don't believe to be the case because they haven't collected money that's owed to them or showed an effort to do so, then I think we have to try to negotiate and look at what the plan of adjustment is going to be for the city. And our position is that the interests of the working people within the city of Detroit should be at the top of the equation and not at the bottom, with bondholders and banks at the top of the equation. So we are concerned about people being able to maintain a lifestyle which will allow them to provide for their family and their dependents, have decent health care, and to be able to retire with a pension.
I want to ask a question that may be a bit emotional. And it is about the obvious issue here. One of the obvious factors in all of this is race. I, as an outsider looking in, I can't help but see this story, this development, this crisis as a huge lesson in the containment of black power, if you will, the ineffectiveness of elected power, elected officials, African American especially, in the city of Detroit, who seem impotent in the face of a crisis to actually flex muscles that are real, that can make change. Is it that this, what we are witnessing here, is a wholesale incapacitation or capitulation of elected officials and political representation of a distressed city and its distressed communities?
Without question, African Americans have been more overwhelmingly affected by the implementation of Public Act 436, which was the impetus for the filing of the bankruptcy. Again, over 700,000 African Americans in Michigan have lost their right to vote on their local level and have been deterred from participating in the electoral process as a result of PA 436. But even with that, we know that African Americans generally vote Democratic more so than Republican. And in our last election, there were more Democratic votes cast than there were Republican votes cast. But as a result of gerrymandering, there were more Republican legislatures elected than Democratic legislatures. So our backs are against the wall. We have some significant work to do, but the work must start with continuing to be involved in the electoral process, not being deterred from voting and participating in the process because you feel your vote doesn't count as a result of PA 436 and the emergency manager. We must still encourage people to participate in the process, to register to vote, and to become educated about those candidates that are running for office. That is the only way that we are going to bring about an ultimate change in the policies and practices that have ultimately resulted in us being under an emergency manager and being subjected to bankruptcy.
And finally, Mr. Saunders, what lies ahead in the coming week?
Well, in the coming weeks, I believe on Monday we will continue with the examination of emergency manager Orr, after which I anticipate that the city will rest its presentation and the unions and challengers to the bankruptcy will begin to present their case. I don't believe that the city has met its case at this juncture. As it relates to the issue of solvency, one of the issues that was brought up and delineated in through the trial is the city has put forth no expert witness to testify concerning its solvency. That is unprecedented in a bankruptcy hearing. They have relied upon consultants that have been hired to work for the city to delineate and articulate that the city is insolvent. That is, for example, like me going to a car salesman and saying to the car salesman, "Mr. Salesman, take a look at my current vehicle. It's a few years old. And Mr. Salesman, will you tell me whether or not you think I should buy a new vehicle from you?" No one does that. No one goes to the car salesman for an assessment as to whether or not the salesman should sell them a vehicle. And that's exactly the type of case the city has put forth in bankruptcy. They've had Ernst & Young, who is being paid to administer the bankruptcy, the Buckfire firm that is being paid to administer the bankruptcy, testify as to the need for bankruptcy with no outside expert. So I don't believe they have met their burden of proof to establish that the city is indeed solvent. Moreover, the testimony has revealed that prior to the filing for bankruptcy, the city had not completed its assessment, nor has it completed its assessment to date, as to what percentage of the pensions are unfunded. They have no firm number in that regard. Additionally, the evidence has revealed that unlike the norm in a bankruptcy filing, the city has failed to put forth a balance sheet showing the value of the city's assets as compared to the value of the city's liabilities. In fact, the city has testified through the witnesses brought forth by Kevin Orr that the only asset that it is attempting to value at this time is the artwork at the Detroit Institute of Arts, and it has not completed that process. As it relates to the city's other assets, it has no valuation for those assets. So how can you file for and be in the process of seeking bankruptcy when you haven't even completed a balance sheet? I don't believe they meet the burden of proof as it relates to solvency, as it relates to good faith. The evidence has clearly established that prior to the retention of Kevin Orr, prior to entering into the consent decree, that the Jones Day law firm had articulated to the governor that Chapter 9 could be used as a vehicle, in their opinion, to trump the state constitution and have pensions included in the equation of bankruptcy. So there was an effort to try to discern how to get to the pensions before the bankruptcy was even filed. I don't believe that evidence is good faith, and I believe that we will begin to even articulate those issues even more as we put on our case beginning next week.
And not to mention the fact that Mr. Orr, who hired the Jones Day law firm to file the bankruptcy, was a managing partner at Jones Day.
Absolutely. Clearly creating an appearance of impropriety. It's an unfortunate circumstance that the Attorney Grievance Commission has ignored that issue to date, because I am very confident that AFSCME filed a grievance with the Attorney Grievance Commission concerning the retention of Jones Day, maintaining that there was a conflict of interest for Kevin Orr to do such, and that was months and months ago, and to date there's been no response to that grievance.
Mrs. Saunders, I want to thank you so much for giving us an inside view of what is going on the legal front with respect to this question, and I hope we will talk again with you very soon. Thank you so much for today.
Thank you for having me, and I appreciate what your station is doing in terms of allowing the public to become informed. Have a great day.
Thank you. We'll take a break and come back right after this. That's Aretha Franklin, of course, Detroit Aretha. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're joined now by Elena Herrada, who was with us yesterday giving us a view from the block, as it were. Elena, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to go with your second installment, and, you know, we're taking this in installments.
Yes.
So we'll continue. So much. I'm so grateful that you can join us today.
Thank you.
What is the mood today in Detroit?
Well, besides it being Halloween, actually,
you've been living Halloween for quite some time, so this should not be an unusual day.
No, this is actually it's kind of a kind of thing because. I'm sorry about the interruptions on the phone. I'm over at what's called the Museo del Norte, which is a museum without walls, and we're putting up our ofrendas for the Day of the Dead. And that's why I had to be on my cell phone today. So we're in the process of commemorating our and also trying to hold ground for our live ones. So there's a lot going on.
Let's stop there for a second. Tell me about that. Let's learn a little bit about El Día de los Muertos.
Día de los Muertos. I'll try to give you a thumbnail sketch of Detroit Mexican history while also sharing with you what the tradition of the Day of the Dead is. But here in Detroit, you know, I come from people who arrived here in 1920, and then there was a massive repatriation, and people were kicked out between 1929 and 39. And my family is among those repatriados who left to Mexico. And my family is from the tiny group that came back because we had no other home but Detroit, which of course informs our attachment to this place and why we won't be kicked out again. But since the repatriation, there was very little migration to Detroit from Mexico until after NAFTA, at which point everybody had to just run for wherever they could find any kind of work, and there was still work to be had here. So around 2003 or 4 was when we began to get bombarded with Mexican immigrants in Detroit. And we were from the old crew. We didn't speak very much Spanish, and we didn't have our traditions from Mexico intact at all. We had no connections to Mexico for the most part. But they brought the new people brought back our traditions, and we're grateful to have them. And for those who didn't get deported in these last couple of years, there's still people here, and we have sort of reunited with the lost families from Mexico. So here we are. And the ofrenda that I'm putting up with my daughter Alejandra today is Alejandra is putting up an ofrenda to the women of Juarez who were murdered on the border. So we're commemorating them all the way on this northern border. And the ofrenda that I'm doing is in honor of the braceros who were killed in the flight of Los Gatos in 1948.
Describe what an oferta is.
Pardon?
Describe what that is.
The braceros were it was a work program for Mexican workers to come and work in.
No, I'm talking about the offering or the symbolism.
What is the offering? What are we doing?
Yes.
This is the first year that they've actually been named, so they didn't have their names were not made public until recently when they were finally discovered as. They were anonymous. They were buried without graves, and hold on 1 second.
Hold on, please.
And so they were buried in unmarked graves until someone finally was able to identify them because one of their grandchildren was able to find his the records of his grandfather who went down in the plane. So there was an Arlo Guthrie song called Deportees, All They Could Call You Was Deportees, and it was about the airplane in Los Gatos that went down. And in the news article, they said they named the pilot, they named the other people, but they said all the rest were just deportees. So since we have their names now, there's 28 people who went down in this plane crash during the Bracero Act, where they were just brought to work and be kicked out at the end of the season. And 28 people were killed in that airplane crash in California. Then now they're named. And there's all over the country, all over this country. And in Mexico, there are memorials being put up to them this Day of the Dead.
And what do people typically do honoring the Day of the Dead?
Well, you take a picture of the person or something that commemorates them. You put their favorite things on the altar. If they had, if they smoked, you put their favorite brand. On this altar, I have food. We have food. We have glasses of water. We have bottles of tequila. We have different things that people would have used in the work of farm workers and some of the food that farm workers eat. There's rice and beans and tortillas, and there's flowers, lots of live flowers. And there's images of our saints, of Our Lady Guadalupe.
Mm-hmm.
And I have 28 little crosses to represent the people, and then there will be one little piece of paper with each of their names on it. So that's my contribution to the memory of the braceros.
That's great.
Everybody does their own way of doing it. If it's somebody that you were very close to, people put up an altar. We also have pan de muerto, which is bread for the Day of the Dead. And they put the a loaf of bread in the image of a person, it looks kind of like a mummy. Those are sold in all the Mexican bakeries, and people buy one and put it on the altar. They're about a foot long. So that's the Day of the Dead that's going on today in Detroit. Other people are doing them to their loved ones in all different representations.
That's great. I'll trade you a little story from Trinidad. What happens in Trinidad when I was a kid, we celebrated 2 days, All Souls Day and All uh-huh. Saints Day.
Uh-huh.
And for the 2 days, you know, I don't know if they do it anymore. It's been a while since I've been back. But you go to the cemetery where your family members and relatives are buried, and you clean up the graves. You have to clean up the graves. And
right.
It's the time of year where whitewash is sold. I mean,
uh-huh.
more than at any other time, you spruce up the grave. And then for the 2 days, I remember my mother would take us, we'd go to the cemetery, And, you know, you have a picnic with the dead.
Right.
you go.
Right.
You go to the picnic. You have a little picnic. You light candles and you pray first. And then you bring out the good food and you sit right there at the gravesite and you have a little picnic. And usually the stories are about the person who is buried there. So you tell us about our grandmother and so forth. And you spend all night practically in the cemetery, and the entire cemetery is just lit up with candles. People praying for the dead. And then, of course, we come home. Sometimes it would be about close to midnight. We hated leaving, but that's what we did in Trinidad when I was a kid.
That sounds exactly like the Mexican tradition. It's exactly the same as the Mexican tradition. That's really amazing. Here we've kind of lost the cemetery part of it, and it's kind of been appropriated by the gentrifiers. There's actually going to be a run of the dead through the cemetery, which is absolutely unthinkable, but they're going to run through the cemetery in a marathon, which I hope that the dead will just grab their ankles and trip them. But, but that's what's going on. So we won't be in the cemetery this year. But there's lots of different ways that people privately. And then, you sort of come up with your own tradition of the way you do things when you're far from home. You sort of come up with your own blend of traditions from the place where you are. So there's a lot of African Americans in Detroit that come to the Day of the Dead exhibits and put their things on the altars and have a shared way of doing that. And people are really happy and find it to be very cathartic. It's very cathartic to have one day to visit with your loved ones. I'm putting up this altar not knowing how I was going to honor the braceros, and as I'm doing it, it's coming to me. It's like, oh, there should be some work gloves on here. Oh, there should be this. Oh, tequila? Okay, you want some tequila? it's really incredible. I feel like there's a direct line, and people are really happy to have their souls being able to rest and to celebrate life with the living.
Well, it's a bit of comfort given the situation that Detroit is in. So, Elena, we leave you to go tend to your altar. And to we'll hook up another day, and we'll begin the story. We'll pick up where we left off.
Oh, thank you so much. I want to mention to you that we're having a press conference today at Oakman Orthopedic School to show that the emergency manager absolutely falsified documents about the condition of the school and said that it had to be closed. And we went in with our own inspector and saw that they were completely lying, and they closed the school for no reason, and they're going to demolish it. And the students that went to school there have no other school to go to. So that's our 3 o'clock press conference today.
And that's going to be our next conversation.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Elena. Thanks so much.
Okay, take care. Okay, bye-bye.
Very, very fascinating. Well, I hope these stories that we've been listening to and the testimony from people who know what's going on in Detroit have given us some pause. Here is a huge crisis. This is a major domestic crisis, but you would never know. We heard here that the Obama administration has not responded, despite the fact that they're all, 700,000 voters, African-American voters, having their votes basically annihilated. Voting rights violations galore going on in Detroit. Where is the Obama administration? A city is about to implode. Where is the Obama administration? People are working full-time and yet are on the street. Where is the Obama administration? Schools are closing. They've closed so many schools that students have no place to go. Where is the Obama administration? You have an illegal takeover of an entire city. Where is the Obama administration? And it's not like this crept up yesterday. This has been going on for years, and we have no federal intervention. You see, this is why I keep pointing to folks, pointing at folks and saying, you know, this blind allegiance to the Democratic Party and to this president, the unwillingness to critique him and to call him on the mat for this. Nobody, oh, we can't criticize him. You know, you're just being so, you know, give the guy a chance. 700,000 people. They have few services left in terms of sanitation and police protection and emergency services and hospitals and so forth. It's all imploding. An entire city. And the media, you're not seeing it on major media. It's not a big deal, is it? And there's a reason. People have written this off because they say, well, these are just a bunch of black folks who have really bad leadership, and let the city go down, 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 down until it is totally empty, and then we'll redesign it to suit our vision. That's what's about to happen. And you heard Attorney Saunders say, we did not have a pre-discussion. You heard him say, this is the beginning of the domino effect. Other cities like Detroit are going to fall in exactly the same pattern. We've come to the end of our program today. Please do join us again tomorrow at 1 o'clock. And remember, this is the biggest story right now in America, and you couldn't tell, because people have just written an entire city off. It doesn't even exist. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow.